Welcome. Welcome to the October Citizens Climate Lobby Call. My name is Mark Reynolds. I am a member of the CCL staff and I'm hosting today's call. Our November conference is open for registration. So far, 1,079 people have registered for November. You're all welcome to do so today if you haven't done so. In our campaign to get emails to President Biden to make sure that a price is part of the reconciliation package, so far, 12,837 of you have written President Biden, which means there's 7 days left to make our goal of 20,000. So let's keep going on that. What's going to happen today is in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing Representative Raymond Ward, which we're very excited and pleased to have on as our guest. He was the first Republican lawmaker to sign on to the op-ed that was published in the Deseret News endorsing fee and dividend. After that, you're going to hear from Ben Pendergrast, our senior director of government affairs, about where we are at this legislative moment. We'll go over what we're doing this month and then go over some of the other highlights that have happened since last month's call. And not to be a surprise or anything, but y'all been busy. I don't know how many of you are on 5 minutes early, but it looks like not only in addition to many of you calling your senators, it looks like we're getting some dogs to do it too, which looked pretty fun to me. Okay, first up, we have Representative Ray Ward, a representative in the Utah State Legislature. We were chatting with Representative Ward before the call, and he was talking about, you know, the Utah form of government's kind of nice because the legislative session is 45 days, and he's a family physician. So it's probably more how we would hope politics is people who are actually out there in life, and then part of their time is serving their community. So I think that's really, really ideal scenario. Kind of fits what we're doing is, you know, our name is Citizens Climate Lobby, but it's about citizens. That's what it's really about. I think the thing that's important to know about Representative Ward is ultimately we ended up with 25 Republicans in the op-ed in the Deseret News supporting endorsing carbon fee and dividend. But the really crucial point is the first person. That's the courageous moment where somebody says, yes, I'll take this step. That's where all the risk is because nobody else is agreeing on it yet. And so we're really happy that Representative Ward could be with us today. We're hoping to hear a little bit about why he likes fee and dividend, what helped in recruiting other Republicans on the bill, and how he sees Republicans could lead on the issue of climate change. So Representative Ward, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for your indefatigable efforts for climate change and just to always keep going after the issue in every little way that you can. I'm happy to speak to why I like fee and dividend. And I like fee and dividend because I think it fits best with my Republican principles of what I just kind of my core beliefs about the way our economy functions best. And so I don't feel like I have a hard time at all making a case for it to my legislature and to my Republican colleagues. And to me, it's a very basic economic thing to say, if a polluter is putting pollution out, that polluter just needs to pay for the cost of the damage of their pollution. We just don't find it odd at all that if a polluter is putting pollution into a river, we say to them, well, that you have to cover the cost of that where you're damaging everyone else. And then we probably still want your product. We may really still need what you're making, but you have to cover the cost of your pollution. And to me, fee and dividend does just that. I mean, it's not easy to set an exact number, but we know that there's some damage. We know it's going to get worse. So let's start with a fee to bring that part of the way back into control. But as a conservative and also as someone who believes that increased taxes as a whole do slow down our economy and make things difficult for people, I don't want that to be a way to just put increased taxes on folks. All I want is for the polluter to pay their cost. And then I want that money to go back out to the American people in a way that makes it so that individual people can still take care of their lives and that we don't disadvantage or hurt people who still need to have energy, who still need to get their lives taken care of. And that simple mechanism and solution to me just seems so much better than government deciding one at a time, well, this industry needs this new regulation on it, and then we hope it runs out. Or this one individual business is our favorite one because they've got new renewable energy. And so we're going to put money into this individual business or this individual industry. Philosophically, it just seems so much better to say, look, what we want is to quit putting out the CO2 pollution. I don't know which is the best way to arrive at that. But I believe that investors and individuals overall as a group, if you just let them make their decisions about where they invest their money and which products they buy, once those products incorporate the cost of the pollution, I believe it will come to a good solution. I think that's the best way to let all the innovation that we still need, because we really do still need additional innovation for this to work out for us. I believe that's the best way to let that happen and incentivize that to happen, instead of the government somewhere picking and saying, well, I think this innovation is the one that's going to work, so that's where I'm going to put all my money. So to me, that makes it an easy case to make. I think switching over and talking about a little bit about how we recruited other Republicans and what it means to be the first one, we started with two or three that we knew would be happy to have our names on that op-ed. And I think those two or three of us, as we worked together, we're easily at the point where it's like, well, it doesn't matter if it's just the two of us or just the three of us. This is a voice that needs to be out there. It needs to be a Republican voice. And that was really kind of the lead-in of the op-ed, right? The lead-in wasn't just, we want fee and dividend. The lead-in was, we need Republican voices in this conversation. You can't have a conversation if only one half of the partnership is doing the talking. A conversation has to be between both parties or all the parties. And once we started with that small group, and then because we were able to speak to Republican principals within the op-ed, then as we went around, then it turned out to be easier than we thought it might be to find others who looked at that and said, yeah, I am happy to have my name on that as well, including some folks that initially we were surprised. And when I say we were going around, let me be clear, that was mostly Tom Moyer and some other folks working with him. So he has just worked so hard here in Utah and brought a positive energy to this particular project, but to many other projects for climate action, to call people back and call people back and be polite and be persistent. And really it was his work that got this kind of snowball to get more folks to come on. But it was gratifying to look back and see, oh yeah, we thought that person was a maybe and they were a yes. We thought that person would be a no, but they were a yes. And then we had enough on that op-ed. And so we'll run a resolution come the legislative session. And that way, even those folks who didn't sign on, at least we can have the discussion with them and say, these are our Republican principles. This is what we want. This is why. Let's discuss it. Will you vote for it if it's a resolution there in the legislative session? The third question about how Republicans can show leadership on the issue. I think anyone, Republican, Democrat, anyone has to determine in their own head if they think that climate change is real, if it's being caused by human emissions, and if it's a problem. And if you come to that conclusion, which more and more people have and are, and hopefully they will, then you just honestly have to say, okay, well, what do I think is the solution that will help? How can we stop this? How can we leave a community and a planet for our children and grandchildren that's good? And then think, which of my other philosophies of the way I believe the economy works fits in with solving this problem? And then once you come to it from that way, I don't have any problem at all of meshing my political beliefs about how the economy works with what I think are the best ways to solve this problem. And I'm thankful that more and more folks are starting to see it that way. I'm so thankful for John Curtis, you know, my congressman here from Utah, getting in and talking about it and working quietly and pushing and pushing and pushing and hopefully getting other Republicans and conservative Republicans to see the advantages of going about it this way. So I'm happy to take questions.
Great. Well, let me start with one, and then I'll ask Flannery what's out in the field. So there were other states that were inspired by what happened in Utah, and yes, Tom Moyer is a rock star in this organization, and he just doesn't draw attention to himself. He just works hard behind the scenes and is persistent and makes remarkable things happen. But for the other states that are looking into this, what guidance can you give them? What recommendations? What are some lessons learned here that will help those efforts be successful?
Well, I think it is important to start with a small nucleus who are committed to it, right? You don't want to go out, you don't want to be approaching someone and saying, well, will you be the first, right? I mean, you need to already have had some conversations. You need to know, you have a couple of friends, I think, and have two or three names on that. Folks who are, where it's not a stretch for them to go out. So for me, it's not a stretch for me to have my name on that in any way. I'm happy to have my name on that if mine's the only name on that. But I understand that it doesn't mean the same thing. If my name's the only name on it and no one else signs onto it, they'll say, that's crazy, Representative Ward. Everybody knows he's crazy. But so it means something much different if you get the other names on. But I do think it's easier if you have enough connections where you've talked with people, you know, who kind of starts on your side. If you can start with three or four that say, yep, I'm good with my name on that, then having those names who everybody respects somebody a little different in your legislature, there's relationships and friendships and groups, then it makes it easier to go to each other group and or each other person and say, look, we've got these five names. We've got these seven names. We've got these 10 names. Would you be the, you know, and if you're not comfortable having your name on this, because we think these are pretty basic Republican principles about a way to solve a problem, free market principles, then help us understand why not. You know, what is it about this that you would say, well, no, I really don't support that part of it. And so even bringing the op-ed to someone lets you have one more conversation to suss out where they are and what their concerns are and push.
Fantastic. Flannery, what are we, what's trending in the Q&A?
Yeah, so I'll start off with one comment that says, upvote to say thank you to Representative Raymond Ward for his support and advocacy. You're a climate champion, and it has all the upvotes. It's at the top of my list. So our folks here are very appreciative of what you're doing. And the next most upvoted question is asking if you have some ideas about how we can get more traction with Republicans at the federal level on this issue.
Other than individual relationships one at a time, I don't know that I have the secret key to that, right? I know my four folks here in Utah, some better than others. I have a little bit more access to Blake Moore and John Curtis because I helped them before they were in office, which is always the best way to get to meet to meet a government official and get to know them and have them know that you support them and like them. But it's just polite persistence over and over and over again that doesn't stop. And in as much as you can, if you get the opportunity to understand what it is that makes them still not support the action, what is it that they're concerned about? And I think, well, I mean, every politician doesn't want to say out loud, but is thinking, well, do a majority of the people who elect me, who might not be the general electorate, right? I mean, so in most Utah districts, it's the Republican primary that determines whether or not you're in office. Do the people who elect me support this position? But find out what they believe and don't believe. And then, so it's also still a battle for the mind and hearts of voters as a whole. And that's why every news story, every post, every conversation we have with folks to help everybody understand that it's a problem matters a little bit at a time.
Well, polite persistence is what we do best here at CCL. So that's, appreciate that advice. You mentioned constituents and the positions of the people that you represent. So we have a question from Connie asking, what response has there been from your constituents to the op-ed?
A little. I you know, an op-ed doesn't go out only to my constituents. It's just out in the community as a whole. And I put it on my little Facebook page. But I've been here long enough that my constituents who are paying attention probably weren't surprised. You know, we've had the conversation before. And I know from surveys that I put out to my constituents that a majority of them, a strong majority of them believe the planet is getting warmer. A very small majority still think that it's caused by humans. So that's very close to 50-50 in my district. I'm not sophisticated enough to sort out exactly all Republican voters or Democrat voters or what in my district, but that's my district as a whole.
Flannery, let me jump in for just a second and then I'll turn it back over to you. So would you mind just saying a little bit about what Mr. Curtis is doing? Because it's important. And again, he's not, you know, he doesn't toot his own horn a lot, but he's quietly doing something important in Congress.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's put together a group. I think it's a conservatives, the conservative climate group. And they had a meeting that they set up here in Salt Lake several months ago and had some other congressmen, congressional representatives come into it. And for a while, Steve Handy, another one of my fellow representatives here in Utah, were angling to just be able to go to, you know, to see what they were doing at the meeting. But then a week before his his chief of staff called us back and told us, no, we couldn't come. And the reason was a good reason. And the reason was to say, look, some of these conversations have to be had where there isn't a spotlight, where you can discuss it among people who you know are your friends and who know think similarly to you, and put some ideas out and get some feedback and put some ideas out and get some feedback till you kind of know that your group of friends, enough of them see it this way that you can talk about it together and not feel like you're at odds with them. And that behind the scenes work isn't easy. You can't always see it from the outside, but that is the kind of thing that Representative Curtis is working on. And the public eye is also important, right? I mean, that for sure is a part of politics. It's being out there and trying to make it through one more town hall with people screaming at you on this side and on that side. But my experience is that's not usually where people change their mind about things, right? That setting is usually where people dig their heels in. But just the behind the scenes, quiet conversations with your own friends, hopefully is where you can hear the idea, say, no, this is important. Hey, you know what? These really are our principles. We need more innovation. This needs to be set up in a way that we incentivize information because innovation, because we're desperately still in need of it to solve this problem. But in the end, all we're asking is that polluters pay the cost of their pollution, and everything else we want to go to let the free market do its work. We're just asking polluters to pay the cost of their pollution. That's it.
Right. And the outdoor winter industry is so important to Utah's economy. Are you hearing much from Snowbird, Alta, Brighton, any of the big resorts about their concern about having enough winter pack every year?
Sure. And they come in and make their case and talk. And that's one voice in the conversation here in Utah. And I think the other voice that I hope that we have a little voice of, and that we need more of a voice of, is to say, look, Utah is a desert state. We are, you know, the second driest state. And I don't know how much actual precipitation will come down year to year, but if we're this many degrees warmer, we will lose this much more to evaporation. So for any given input, there will not be as much left for us to use if we're evaporating it off faster. But those voices are competing, you know, with hundreds of other voices that come in. Our rural economy here, there are still parts of it that rely on the fossil fuel industry and that start from a place of just many times visceral hatred towards the federal government, where the government controls most of the land and the federal government, you know, just this week they put back in Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, the Biden administration put back to their full boundaries from before. And so just to get the folks, the local officials, the county commissioners there to even have the conversation, it sometimes is really difficult.
Mm. Yeah, and I loved what you said about, you know, liking to put the op-ed in front of people because they might say they're opposed, but that's not the end of the conversation for you.
Right.
You ask them why they're opposed, which is, yep, you know, just has things go further. Flannery, what else is out there in the general questions?
Sure. We have a question from Alex. First, she says, I'm grateful for your words and your work to help us all reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And then the question is, my Republican senator thinks the price on carbon will hurt working families and kill jobs. How would you respond to that type of objection?
So I would say, look, this is, as a Republican or a conservative or whatever words you want to put on it, I do believe that increased taxes as a whole make things difficult for people and make it hard for a business to thrive. So this is not a net tax increase. That's why it's not just a carbon fee full stop. It's a carbon fee and dividend, that those monies are all dividended back to people. So the folks still on net have the same amount of money that they can purchase products. It's just in their better interest to purchase those that don't have the emissions. And it's in the better interest of companies to make products that don't pollute. So there's still an equal ability to produce jobs. There's still an equal ability to buy things with the products, with the money you have. You get that dividend back, and that dividend can be structured in a way that if we want to say, well, there's a little bit of a sliding scale towards those who are towards the bottom end of the economic spectrum, that's fine with me because I don't want to disadvantage those folks.
So I think you're in a unique position of also being a physician, and there are definitely health risks associated with burning fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always looking for you know, what are the messengers that don't trigger either side, right? I mean, whoever you picked off, somebody doesn't like them, right? But do you ever speak to that about the, you know, increased asthma in some communities and places where burning fossil fuels is having adverse health effects?
Sure. Well, so it's an interesting dynamic. So here in Utah, we live in a bowl geographically, and for a certain kind of air pollution, that is winter inversions, we have it really pretty bad. So if we get a really cold stretch in the winter, then the geography just makes it so that whatever we put out as pollution sticks there for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks until the next storm comes in. And so in Utah, with good lobbying and good attention to it by people, there's bipartisan, there's widespread agreement that air quality is important. We need to do things to help make our air quality do better. That's still not easy to decide what to do. It's still a very difficult thing to know always what to do. But the agreement that the air quality is important, we have that across all political groups in Utah. And to me, in some ways that helps, and in some ways it doesn't help, because then it has been so easy for people to say, well, you should reduce your carbon because it will help with the air quality. Mm. And they say, well, look, if you talk about climate change, that's going to be toxic. No one wants to talk to you about that. Just talk about air quality, where everyone agrees with you already that it's a problem. And I for my own self, I just made a decision that I'm just going to go the other way. Mm. I'm going to say, I understand that climate change is not a local issue. The CO2 that we put out here does not disadvantage us here. We can put out as much CO2 as we want locally, and the CO2 locally doesn't hurt us locally. It is a global issue. If we, not meaning the Wasatch Front, but the whole world puts out CO2, we as a whole planet are really going to suffer from it, and that's harder to find policies that work. But to me, people have avoided talking about it so long because it was easier to talk about clean air, that to me, I perceive it's important to say, look, I'm here to talk to you about this other problem, about the global issues, not only the local air issues. They're still there. And if you want clean air here, if you want clean air, then transitioning to these things that don't burn fossil fuels is going to help us in the long run. It won't help us this next winter. It won't help us in 2 winters. But in 20 or 30 years, when we have managed to make this transition, it will help us a lot.
Great. Well, Representative Ward, wow, thank you so much. We've really been looking forward to this, and I'm so grateful that you could make time. I know, you know, you've got the practice, you've got your member, you have a family. There's a lot of things you could be doing. So thank you for making some time for us, and feel free to stay on the next 20 minutes if you want, but certainly we know you're busy and understand if you need to drop off, but thank you so much.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. Great. Our next speaker is Ben Pendergrass, who is the Senior Director of Government Affairs. Did I get that right this time, Ben?
Yep.
So we are at such a crucial point in this organization. I mean, we've been pushing for something for 13 years. We've got, we're at least in the discussion and reconciliation. There's a lot of other things happening in DC. You know, we needed to get the debt ceiling dealt with so that we could even talk about some other things. So Ben, could you just kind of give us an overview of where you and the government affairs thing take things? And then we'll hopefully have time for Q&A with you also.
Absolutely, Mark, thanks. First, I really want to take a moment to acknowledge the accomplishments of last year. You know, last December, 3 CCL supporting asks, the USIT Act, the BEST Act, and the Climate Ready Fisheries Act, were all included in the end of the year omnibus bill. CCL played a key role in building support for those bills. In one case, CCL volunteers got 27 co-sponsors in 1 week to make certain the BEST Act was included in that package. And in fact, the omnibus bill's energy provisions ended up being the biggest clean energy legislation in over a decade. In the spring, the Growing Climate Solutions Act passed the Senate 92-8. CCL lobbied extensively on that bill in spring meetings, and in the run-up to that vote, CCLers generated thousands of calls and emails to Senate offices. That was the biggest bipartisan vote for a climate bill that I'm aware of, and CCL can take a lot of credit for that. Now for the big one. To quote Senator Whitehouse this week, it is more likely than not that the Senate Finance Committee will include a carbon pollution fee in their part of the reconciliation package being worked on by the Senate right now. Last week, Senator Wyden, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, confirmed that the Senate Majority Leader had asked him to craft legislation that would put a price on carbon emissions. I have to say, every meeting, you've had over the last several years on a carbon price, every new co-sponsor of the Energy Innovation Act, all the letters to the editor and op-eds, and the thousands of calls and emails you've made over the last several months has gotten us to the moment where, for all intents and purposes, the United States Congress is drafting, considering, and will be debating legislation to put an escalating price on carbon emissions starting at $15 to $20 a ton and return most of the revenue to American households with a border carbon adjustment. I think that sounds pretty familiar to most of you. Now, while this does not look like what we think of as the traditional legislative process, and maybe it doesn't feel as real because you can't look up a bill number and text on congress.gov, and we won't be able to watch the committee mark up the bill on C-SPAN, it is very real. You can think of this moment like we are almost in the committee markup phase of the legislative process, one that could go on for several weeks, and we got here because of your work. This really is a tremendous milestone we have reached. But of course, we are not at the end yet. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and even President Biden could not tell you what the final reconciliation package is going to look like right now. But I do believe we are in a very good position, and we have a lot of support in the Senate. And you might be wondering, well, what about the House reconciliation bill, and how is this process going to play out? Well, the Finance Committee will keep working on the details of the carbon price and the other climate priorities in the bill, along with the other Senate committees. And over the next month or two, Democratic members of the Senate will negotiate the final version of the bill. Some details or a framework may be released, but it is really unlikely we will see complete legislative text until an agreement has been reached and a vote scheduled. And once that agreement is reached, passage in the Senate is likely. Now, the House will still have to vote on the Senate bill, and they will have some input on the Senate negotiations. But at this point, you can kind of look at that House bill as something of a wish list. The Senate is where most of this will be decided. There will be a tax on the bill as a whole. There will be a tax on the carbon price for both the left and the right, and we will mobilize when needed. Be on the lookout for guidance on what you can be doing to be helpful. And just remember, because you're not seeing something reported on, doesn't mean it's not happening. And don't worry about timelines or deadlines. You can see that those often come and go. There might be some other things you're wondering as well, like, is CCL working to reach out to X member of the House or Senate that I might have seen made a public statement about a concern around a carbon price? Yes. A lot of our efforts lately have been targeted. And so if we are focusing on a particular member of Congress, you might not hear a lot about it if you don't live in that state or district. You might be wondering, is CCL working with other groups? Absolutely. Every week we are working with an ever-growing coalition that is supporting these efforts to include the carbon price. Are we working with key congressional offices? Absolutely. We stay in close contact with the folks who are working most directly on this. I also want to emphasize that this is not only about a carbon price. CCL can take a lot of credit for raising climate as an issue and making it a top priority for Congress. And there are other things that are in the mix that will be good for the climate, for frontline communities, for EV infrastructure, et cetera. We have been focused on the carbon price because, well, we're usually focused on a carbon price, and it was the key component still needed in the package to hit 50% reduction in emissions by 2050. This is going to be a really intense time, but we've gotten this far together, and because of your dedication and efforts, we're going to get to the finish line and pass the most significant climate legislation ever.
Great. Flannery, what's your number one trending item at this point? Ben, thank you for that.
Okay, one question we have from Betty is, does passing a fee and dividend with a border adjustment as part of reconciliation have the same durability as passing it in a standalone bill?
Essentially, yes, because the provisions are tax related. Even if you passed it through regular order, it could still be undone through reconciliation in the future. But so we want to continue to build a durable bipartisan support for it, even if we don't have that Republican support, because quite frankly, reconciliation is just a partisan process. But we can still build bipartisan support now and in the future for the policy itself.
Okay. And can you just acknowledge the role of the dividend in the current discussions? Just sort of say that again for people that a dividend is in the mix?
Yes. Right now, things are very dynamic. I think the key term for this process is dynamic and ever-changing. Something that might be true in the morning might not necessarily be true in the afternoon, and then it might be true the next day. And right now, what Senate Finance Committee is working on is where most of the revenue is returned to American households. That number could edge slightly up or slightly down, but they too want to fall right in line with our guidelines of protecting most American households.
Can I follow up on that, Flannery, with something? So the press secretary was asked if there was a carbon tax and money rebated to households, if that would fit with President Biden's pledge not to raise taxes on people making less than $400,000. And can you just assure us that she in fact said, yes, that would still work with what his pledge was?
Yes, that is what the president's press secretary said. And this is the working premise of the Senate Finance Committee. Chairman Wyden also believes this.
Okay, we have a question from Alexa, just clarifying, how much should volunteers talk about this information that you're sharing in their discussions with congressional staff or in lobby meetings?
And this is very public information now. I mean, whatever, there was extensive conversations over the summer that were the quiet behind the scenes building support, but this is out there now. This is part of the public debate. Members are talking about it more and more publicly. You're seeing it in the newspapers. So they can certainly bring it up, especially with their Democratic senators, to express support and make sure they understand the depth of grassroots support for this policy.
Okay, and we have a couple of questions about Senator Joe Manchin. So just wondering, what's your take on the impact that he will have in this process and any read that you have on his stance around carbon pricing?
Well, Senator Manchin has certainly been one of the most popular guys in DC recently, or unpopular, I guess, depending on how you look at it. And yes, he will play a role in this debate. I mean, he is the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. He is a pivotal vote. And he has not slammed the door to a carbon price. He has said it's something that could be interesting depending on how the revenue is used. We know workers in West Virginia, particularly in the coal industry, really could use a lifeline to transition to a low carbon economy. And I think at the end of the day, Senator Manchin is really going to look at what benefits West Virginia, and a carbon price can certainly be structured in a way that is beneficial for his constituents.
Okay, great. Okay, the questions are flooding in now. This is a question from George asking, will there be any kind of exemption to the carbon fee? And of course, I know that things are still changing and dynamic, as you said, but as far
that
as-
That is something that's very, very dynamic right now and up in the air. I mean, the intent is to have as wide range of a carbon price as possible that achieves the greatest emissions. Now, like we look to the agriculture exemption and the Energy Innovation Act, there certainly could be some exemptions on the table. And I think for us, it's about maintaining the integrity of the emissions reductions achievable. And if there are certain exemptions that come into play that make it more likely to pass, but don't hurt that top line number, some of the exemptions, you know, would reduce emissions reductions potential by like 1.5% over 10 years. We can live with things like that because at the end of the day, we'll still get to that 50%. We'll still lock in a lot of these emissions reductions. And there are other policy areas where we can make up for those exemptions as well.
We've got a couple questions. Ben, you mentioned that CCL is working with other groups. So a couple questions about what other groups are we working with, and if progressive or other environmental organizations like the Sierra Club or others, are they also open to carbon pricing?
Well, right now, you know, some groups have been focused like we have always had a particular focus on carbon pricing, and some groups have really been focusing on portions of the package that are most important to them. And there's still a lot of them are staying in that lane. But I can say a lot of big groups have come off the sidelines and are working in a major way on the carbon pricing provisions. And you'll see people like CEO Climate Dialogue coming out with public pronouncements about supporting price and reconciliation. We know their members are in there. lobbying, and that's the same for a lot of other groups without getting into like the long list. But I can tell you, we started with a core group of five or six organizations, and now that coalition has ballooned to I don't even know an exact number. All I know is there's more than I can count on some of the calls we have on a weekly basis.
Flannery, thank you so much for that. And Ben, I'm not going to hold you to this, but what's your, you know, best guess estimate about how timing might go down at this point?
It's going to move as fast or as slow as Mr. Manchin wants it to. And so right now, I think there's going to be a lot of back and forth over the next coming month, and we'll start to see things really come together in November. Unclear when we'll have a final vote.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for your steady hand and for being available to join us on today's call. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Mark.
Great.
Okay. Thank you all.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to go over what we're asking you to do this month. First, as I mentioned at the top of the call, that the November conference is open for registration, and we'd like to have as many of you there as possible. Our keynote speaker, Dr. Ayanna Johnson, I think so many of us are so excited to hear what she has to say, and somebody that we have been wanting to get in front of us for a long time. This will be also probably our last big push, hopefully before reconciliation is actually done. But so, you know, there's a two-track thing happening. There's the actual conference, and then we'll be doing November lobbying also. I'll be going over in a few minutes all the press you've been generating, but there should be a huge opportunity. We've got a lot of op-ed templates out there that you can use. Many of you are taking advantage of it to get a lot of things published. We're having really solid work with Letters to the Editor. So just really please keep the push on that. And then there's a unique opportunity right now in that the Biden administration has opened a new correspondence office, or at least the correspondence office is now open to tweeting. And so there's a kind of window of time where we can get their attention now by tweeting the correspondence office. There's a link to that in the action sheet, and hopefully get our message in before they're inundated with messages from all kinds of directions. So it looks like, as usual, Brett has posted that in the chat already. Yeah, I mentioned at the start of the call, we are at 12,837 emails to President Biden. We've got 7 days left to get to the goal of 20,000. So anything you can do, anybody you can ask, let's just keep the press on so that it's not just the enormous amount of activity with the House and Senate, but we're also keeping the pressure on with the White House itself. And we've been told that emails in particular work well with the White House. What about the last few months in terms of letters to Congress? In the last 3 months, you generated 101,173 letters to Congress in 3 months, 101,173 letters to Congress. That is remarkable. So given there's been so much press with reaching out to offices and to the president, you know, what's been happening with traditional media, op-eds, letters to the editor, radio, television. Well, last month, there were 672 outputs in that area. That is by far the highest month we've ever had. So in addition to the huge press with Congress and the White House, you're still really hitting hard out in traditional media. So thank you for that. Also quite extraordinary. Also the highest total since the pandemic, there were 86 tabling events that happened last month. I don't know how many of those were actually people going back to farmers markets or doing it virtually, but it really shows that you're finding ways to get out in front of people again. And so 86 tabling events is, I mean, it's just, it's so dramatic compared to how hard this last couple of years have been. I also wanna just give a shout out to Christine for getting the faith letter published in Kentucky. Thank you for that. Trusted messengers are really, really important. And also to Barry and Kathy in LA for getting the roundtable with Representative Liu and Danny Richter. You know, lots of times one of the things people ask us is, my member's on the bill, what can I do? Well, holding a roundtable with over 150 people registered with that representative and someone from our organization, Danny Richter, is an example of the kinds of things you can do with people who are already on the bill. Next month's call is the national conference. So it won't be just a standalone call. It'll be the whole conference over the weekend of November 13th. Very much looking forward to that tour. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next month.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.